couple of minutes, so take your time and talk directly to our audience.
Mostly, I really want to say thank you to Iran, to the people of Iran, for welcoming me here, for welcoming me here as someone whose government is, you know, carrying out a genocide against Palestine, against the Iranian people, against the Axis of Resistance. It is an honor to be welcomed here with such kindness and grace. And, you know, as someone living in the United States, I guess I'll quote another great leader, the great martyr Hassan Nasrallah, who always emphasized that it is not Israel that controls the United States. It is the United States that controls Israel. And I think with this latest aggression against Iran, that was incredibly clear, that the U.S. is giving the green light for all of these attacks, no matter how much they might appear to keep their hands off. Ultimately, this is a strategy, this genocide, and this broader war that is being carried out. It is a broader strategy of U.S.-led imperialism to maintain its hegemony, which is crumbling in the face of the anti-imperialist resistance and the new world order that is emerging. And so when we fight for Palestine, it is not it cannot be seen as separate from this broader struggle, from the struggle you know, against the sanctions on Cuba and Iran. It cannot be seen as separate from the struggle of Black and Indigenous people in the United States who are being oppressed and are being killed by the police. I think learning about the Palestinian struggle is a gateway to learning about the struggles of oppressed people across the world. And we have to, you know what we are really up against, which is a global system of imperialism that will only be defeated if we open up fronts against it all across the world. Death by a thousand cuts. And it, yes, has been a great honor to be here. It has been really moving just to witness the destruction caused by the attacks. Today, we know we visited the sites of where civilian homes were destroyed and families were martyred. We visited the cemetery where the martyrs have been buried. But also, so importantly, we saw people rebuilding from the destruction, and we saw just the incredible unity of the Iranian people in the face of these attacks. And I heard a lot of people saying that this war has only made us stronger. And so the last thing I'll say is just, we can't afford to be defeatist, and we have to have revolutionary optimism that victory is dear and is possible within our lifetimes.
Carla Walsh, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Of course. And thank you for being with us on another soap. Thank you so much, and goodbye until next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, help the needy. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on Iron Bush Radio, me sister Zainab. And obviously, so when we're talking about helping the needy, in this circumstance, I'm actually not talking about, like, let's say, giving financial or material help. I'm going to focus more on the idea that we help, maybe also by giving our time and giving advice, maybe even sharing knowledge. Because really, in our day-to-day lives, because obviously we all have very busy lives where we work, maybe we study, maybe we also have families, young children, or children who are at university. But, you know, our lives are busy. So one of the most precious things for us, for sure, is our time. And I think it's much easier for us typically to just give some money, donate something. But I think often we are much more reluctant to really be generous with our time. And yet very often this is the one thing that could really benefit others, and that is the one thing that people really need from us. Because, you know, people have issues, people have problems, people are going through challenges, I think, these days more and more. So maybe if you think, if you speak with people in your surroundings, family members, your relatives, neighbors, other friends, colleagues, typically you might find these days that people are going through so many different hardships. Maybe a family member has cancer, is ill, has had an accident. Maybe someone has lost their job. Maybe another friend is finding it difficult to scrape together a deposit or a security bond for their next rental. Just sort of listen in, observe what's going on. And, you know, obviously sometimes people, yeah, do need money, do need that sort of help. But often people just need the listening ear. And very often, obviously, we often find that people are not going to actually ask for help. Welcome back to A to Z here on Iron Bush Radio with me, sister Zainab. And as I've been talking about helping the needy, and especially the needy in terms of our time, our advice, maybe our knowledge. And obviously, I just want to also remind all of us that people will not necessarily tell us. They don't always tell us what's going on in our lives. So sometimes we actually need to be aware of that and actually just sort of check in on our friends. And obviously this is something that's that we're asked to do anyway. We should sort of, if we haven't heard from someone, and see, I think it's after 3 days, we should check on someone. You know, obviously, and we're all connected, let's say, virtually these days anyway, by through social media, or we just sort of chat with people on the phone. We don't necessarily see all our friends day to day. Sometimes we're separated by great distances. But, you know, it's just this onus to just, you know, contact our friends, keep in touch with them, just so we know what's going on. Like, is it useful for them to, so they can actually, they've got someone to talk to. Maybe they're worried about a very sick member of their family. And also, even though we probably make dua for our friends the whole time, but if we can then, if we find out that someone, you know, maybe their mother, their father has cancer, is seriously ill, it actually informs our dua, so we can make a more precise dua, which, inshallah, is maybe even more useful. So this is something we need to bear in mind. And, you know, and I just thought, and I should mention just one of the examples in the lives of one of our martyrs, of martyr of service, actually, the former president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Shahid Raisi. So he, for example, even when he was working the judiciary, would have sort of weekly open meetings. And, you know, he would actually, sometimes he would even be there until night, just chatting with people, and they'd even come to him just to sort of solve financial problems. So presumably he was even sort of helping with that. But obviously the main thing is he was donating so much of his time. So I pray that this is something that we can really give a lot more of, especially in these busy days where, you know, people's lives are becoming increasingly complex. And I say complex for a reason. So we really need to be much more aware of that. So inshallah, this is just a reminder for us. And I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on RIB English Radio with me, Sister Zainab, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Hello and welcome to Unscripted. I'm Kabet Akwai. We have the pleasure of having with us today Susan Abulhawa. Susan Abulhawa is a Palestinian-American scientist, writer, and activist. Her first novel, Mornings in Jenin, was translated into 32 languages and sold more than 1 million copies. The sales and reach of her debut novel made Abulhawa the most widely read Palestinian author of all time. Now, she was also born to Palestinian refugees of the 1967 war, which makes her that much of an expert on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, especially with the genocide that's going on in the Gaza Strip. Susan Abulhawa, welcome to Unscripted.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. We understand that you went to the Gaza Strip. You said that that changed your life. The totality of the devastation, according to what I read, to have overwhelmed you. And to use your words, actually, quote, it has honestly changed my life in a way that was sometimes difficult to put into words, is what you stated. Now, just recently, you had also the U.S. envoy to the Middle East, or we call West Asia, Stephen Witkoff, who also visited the Gaza Strip. Do you think he saw what you saw and that it changed his life or impacted or affected it in any shape or form?
I mean, I can't speak for what's in another person's heart, but I do know that Steve Witkoff is a Zionist at heart. I mean, he has a history of exhibiting that. I don't think he wanted to see what I saw. I don't, even if he had an opportunity to do so, he didn't want to. He was happy with the sanitized and very limited version that was engineered for them at the GHF sites. I doubt it. These are committed Zionists. They are Jewish supremacists, and he is one of that network that pervade the U.S. government. And so, no, I don't think our experiences are the same. I went to Gaza as a human being, as a Palestinian, as someone who is concerned with the rights and the well-being and the protection of the most vulnerable people on the earth, who are being literally attacked by the most powerful countries in the world. I went there as a woman, as a mother, as a writer, to collect stories, to bring in aid, to do whatever I could as an individual to provide relief in the midst of what I very early on recognized as an unfolding Holocaust.
One of the statements that came on Witkoff's visit, and I'm using him not in particular just to broadcast him, but rather some of the actions that was described, and in this case I'm going to use statements coming from Hamas, which is quite telling. One of them was that Hamas said that his visit was a show and that it was a propaganda show to quell the growing anger over the U.S. partnership with the Zionist regime, as Hamas calls them, and imposing hunger on the residents of Gaza Strip. Do you think that Hamas has a valid point there?
Absolutely, and they're absolutely right. Israel had a problem with the images that were coming out of Gaza of starving children. So at first they tried to, you know, their propaganda is so ugly. They were saying that, why is it just children starving and their parents seem to be fat, which is of course a lie. But then, you know, there were images of starving, emaciated, skeletal men and women who were also dying. And there were, you know, genocide and starvation scientists and experts who explained that, you know, usually children are the first to become skeletal because they have far fewer fat reserves and tissues, tissue reserves. And so the next phase of the propaganda was to claim that the starvation was engineered by Hamas. Of course, everything is Hamas. And what I was told from friends on the ground, that Israel was actually allowing in tiny amounts of food and even fresh fruit food in collaboration with a few corrupt merchants. And they would take their embedded journalists into these places to you know, try and prove that there's no starvation. So Witkoff's trip was just another one of these tricks to obscure the unfolding horrors on the ground. And, you know, they do this, and this is the reason why no international journalists are allowed in. Gaza is a massive crime scene, and they don't want anyone probing it. And anyone, and they will allow in only enough people to a controlled and staged area in order to push back against the overwhelming forensic evidence that they are starving people to death, that they have been committing a Holocaust, that this is a long desired Zionist aim to remove Palestinians from their ancestral homeland in order to replace them with foreign imported Jews.
Indeed. We're going to get back to the famine issue again because there's lots to cover there. But before that, I have to say that I listened to your speech that happened at the Oxford Union, at UK's Oxford University, and it was really, really moving. I didn't expect that. And I've covered this Gaza wars way back in 2007-08 throughout. And if you're familiar with the station, which I guess you're somewhat familiar, we cover this every day. You know, I've seen the gore, I've seen the shocking images, but it really, and I'm not saying this to just because you're a guest on this program, but there were some very moving statements you made there to describe what is happening, where the title, "This House Believes Israel is an Apartheid State Responsible for Genocide," that was a conclusion that was reached. But then came the censorship and came the fact that even there were moves to shut down the Oxford Union. Tell us what happened there. What did you say that, well, aside from me, and I'm sure many were moved just like I was, that made them whoever they are, that maybe you can tell us, to view this as something that should be censored?
So the president of the Oxford Union at the time, Ibrahim Osman Malafi, did not censor the speech, and he uploaded it in its totality because there was nothing illegal, nothing that could not be substantiated. There was nothing. There were no lies. There was, you know, it was everything I said was grounded in documented history and lived experience. And so it was uploaded in its totality, which is why we were able to get that ultimately from the archives after they edited it and uploaded a reduced version where they took out certain statements. The claim was that it was incitement to racial hatred or something like that. For example, one of the lines in there was about the well-documented incidents in Lebanon in the 1980s when Israel dropped or left booby-trapped toys that exploded when excited children picked them up. This is a matter of record, but they removed that. And I think, you know, Israel can say they can give themselves plausible deniability about collateral damage, you know, about Hamas or Hezbollah or whatever else. But when you leave booby-trapped toys, there is no mistaking the intention of that. There's no mistaking the fact that you are trying to murder and maim children. And so I think that's why they took it out. Now, it's not so. And when I say they, these are the powerful forces that are situated behind the facade of students at the Oxford Union. They are wealthy trustees and Zionists throughout the UK who lobbied the Oxford Union heavily to remove my speech in particular. And we are in a legal battle with them because I don't accept first of all the perversion of my intellectual labor and my intellectual property, and also the perversion of the historic record in service of Zionism, basically.
Mm-hmm. Well, there were so many things that you said that I really want to get more an idea from you in terms of this. Particular setting, so I'm going to go at it, and I picked one that had Benjamin Netanyahu, that you said, a Polish Jew whose real name is Benjamin Milakowski, or Milakowski.
Milakowski, yeah,
and,
or however you pronounce.
Yes, once bemoaned a missed opportunity during the 1989 Tiananmen Square, where I guess he said that while the world attention was focused on China, that he wanted to expel large parts of the Palestinian population there. Also, you went on to say there how some of their articulated solutions to the nuance of our existence include a break-their-bones policy in the 80s and 90s ordered by Yitzhak Rubitsov, a Ukrainian Jew, who changed his name to Yitzhak Rabin. Now, tell us about these two that I picked here. And I know I'm merging this into one, but again, these were what I just dissected from your speech there.
So, yes, so Yitzhak Rabin, whose real name is Rubitsov, was the architect of a policy that was dubbed Break Their Bones, in which Israeli soldiers, because the first Intifada was largely nonviolent. I mean, it was children throwing rocks at tanks, basically. But mostly it was civil disobedience. And so the Break Their Bones policy was an order to soldiers to break the bones of Palestinians, to beat them until their bones were broken. There is a harrowing video that was filmed clandestinely in the 1980s showing soldiers who took three young men into a remote area and were stretching their arms out and then, you know, holding them and just beating their arms and legs with stones until they broke. And this video is like 20 minutes long, And it shows the labor, how hard it was for them to do it. You know, the soldiers get tired and they go. And it's so this was a policy. It was a there were so many Palestinian children who would be grabbed by soldiers. Children as young as 3 and 4 years old and 5 years old, they would grab them and they would put their hands on a rock and just crush their hands with rocks, with purportedly the rocks that they threw to teach them a lesson. This was a policy. There's a whole generation. There are generations of Palestinians who've been maimed, whose limbs have been maimed or torn or amputated because of repeated Israeli policies to destroy our bodies.
Indeed. Well,
to make So that was the break their bones policy. The other part you mentioned was when Netanyahu bemoaned the missed opportunity during Tiananmen Square. And this is this was a speech that he gave to university students. I think it was Hebrew University, if I recall, but I might be mistaken about the precise university. But it was a speech he gave to them in the 80s. And it sort of exemplifies how this is, you know, Israel's aim has always been to remove the Palestinians and take their place. That really laments so-called missed these kinds of missed opportunities, which I think is playing is sort of at the heart of what we're seeing in Gaza. For example, throughout Israeli society, throughout their political life, and especially their academic life, there is this notion that Ben-Gurion didn't finish the job. If he had only finished the job and killed us all or expelled us all, they wouldn't be in this situation. There's also, you know, there's this lament as well that in 1967, they should have pushed harder to get rid of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. And at every turn, right, there is, and also in the 80s, people might not remember this, but of course, we Palestinians know this history in our bones, and so do the Lebanese. In 1982, Israel surrounded Lebanon. They cut off food and water and supplies to the city for nearly 3 months, and they bombarded them with bombs in Beirut to the point that Ronald Reagan had called Menachem Begin and said, look, this is a Holocaust. Ronald Reagan called it a Holocaust. So this is not the first time Israelis have done this. And so Begin was forced to kind of, you know, stop that, stop what they were doing. And again, there is still this this notion in the Zionist psyche that if he had just pushed through, right, Lebanon would be northern Israel. This is what they want. This is what they've always wanted. This has always been part of the Zionist plan to take Lebanon, to take Gaza, and get rid of all of us. And this is what I believe is playing out in Gaza. Benjamin Netanyahu is at the tail end of his life. He has wanted to do this his whole life. He had an opportunity, which I believe they engineered to some extent. I believe they knew there was a plan, and I believe that they wanted to make it as sensational as possible to have their propaganda was, this is our 9/11 moment. Mm-hmm. They fully expected to do what the United States did and not be held accountable, to bomb their way, destroy and kill, and they made it as sensational as possible, right? They killed their own people. All of those cars that were at the Nova Festival, every single one of them was bombed by their own Apache helicopters. 28 helicopters that had to reload at least once, emptied all their firepower. The resistance did not have that kind of firepower on their little motorcycles and mopeds to cause that kind of damage. That was entirely done by Israel. So they killed their own people, and to blame Hamas. And then I'm not saying that Hamas didn't kill people. Of course they did. But we know what Hamas's aims were, and they've articulated that. And that wasn't enough. They had to create these sensational lies about beheaded babies and babies in oven and mass rape. Every single instance of these claims have been thoroughly debunked. And so they lied. They wanted this international uproar that would not that would just look the other way no matter what they did. But I think they deeply miscalculated. They did not understand the resolve of the resistance, the resolve of the Palestinian people, because colonizers always underestimate the attachment of indigenous people that indigenous people have to their land and to their roots and to their ancestors. And they are encountering this. And he's still pushing through because this is, you know, he's trying to fix what his predecessors didn't do.
Well, they are doing what perhaps what we thought was behind closed doors in terms of a genocide. We thought that some of the statements that we're hearing now is not what was said before, and that right now is when they are coming out in the open day, meaning the Israeli officials. But from what I read through over here, it seems like the genocidal statements was there from way back. For example, you said that there's a new discourse that has arisen, frustrated by Palestinian resilience. This is something that you said, and that was especially after a massive natural gas field was discovered off the northern Gaza, worth trillions of dollars. For example, you mentioned Colonel Ephraim Eitan, who said in 2004, quote, "We have to kill them all." Aaron Sofer, so-called intellectual and political advisor. Again, things that you covered in your speech, that we have to kill and kill and kill all day, every day. And then fast forward to today, in 2025, Minister of Social Equality and Women's Advancement, May Galan of Likud. "I am personally proud of the ruins of Gaza, and that every baby, even 80 years from now, will tell their grandchildren what Jews did." So what we are seeing, this genocide play out, as people are now well aware of the term, in real time.
Exactly. Well, I'll tell you, when I was in Gaza, when I was, you know, looking around at utterly bewildered, and this was still in 2024, and it has gotten infinitely worse. But when I was there, looking around at people who were just utterly bewildered, disheveled, hygiene was a problem because of lack of water. Israel bombed all the water resources. And I kept remembering this quote by Raphael Eitan. Also, I think he said this in the 80s, I think 86 perhaps, I can't remember. But he said, when we have settled all the land, all the Arabs will be able to do will be to scurry around like drugged cockroaches in a bottle. Reducing and degrading Palestinians has been a long time Zionist fantasy. And I think that's what they're doing. There is this deep jealousy that they have of the people who truly possess the roots that they covet in the land. They resent the fact that despite their siege, despite the constant bombing that they've done over the years, Palestinians in Gaza still managed to create a beautiful life, to build, you know, everybody, they keep saying, oh, Palestinians could have built, they could have done this, but actually they did. There were beautiful cafes, even with such limited resources. Palestinians kept education as a premium. There were multiple universities throughout Gaza, and people still sought advanced degrees, medical degrees, PhDs, master's master's degrees, architectural degrees, art degrees. They hate that. They hate that. They think that we are supposed to be, as one Zionist said, waiters and woodcutters. They, in the Zionist imagination, we are meant to be a cheap labor force. Mm-hmm. How dare us become professionals? How dare us be writers and creatives and intellectuals? How dare us have modern buildings and cultural institutions and writing salons and museums? And how dare us? They cannot abide that. And it is no accident that Israel, one of the first places they went after were the universities. They particularly occupied the universities and then detonated in them. We've all seen the footage of soldiers detonating the Islamic University of Gaza, Al-Azhar University. Every single institution of higher learning has been utterly decimated.
Well, the things that you're talking about are so shocking, and it really brings me, when you I was listening to you, wondering, well, you speak eloquently about what has happened. You really depict a picture that is out there that is not only not covered as much as it should, but rather misunderstood because the West in particular, generally speaking, and in particular their media organizations, obviously want to change the narrative against some of the things that you have said. I'm wondering if there was enough coverage the way you just described the realities, whether we would be looking at a different landscape, although I think that the landscape has changed in terms of the views that people generally have on the Israeli regime.
So absolutely. I mean, Western media have largely acted as stenographers for Israel. And if you look at the owners and the advertisers and the editors at these media outlets, they are Zionist ideologues in large part. Sometimes they're even Mossad agents, as the head of the Middle Eastern Bureau of the BBC, for example. That has been a big scandal, and he's still there. He's still deciding the coverage of what's happening. But however, the difference now is that there are other media outlets that are accessible to the West, and so it becomes harder to gatekeep information. Media outlets like yours, like Press TV, Electronic Intifada, and so many other independent media outlets and journalists who have been covering this with a conscience and with fact and truth. I think, however, in general, across the board, people tend to focus on this moment in isolation. People generally start with October 7th. And even though there are some media outlets have pushed back and said this goes back to 48, I think it's important to view this in a much larger frame, not just Palestinian history, but the history in the region, to look at the kind of propaganda that Zionists have promulgated. Even if you look at Iraq, for example, the misinformation, the propaganda, the way that media outlets lined up as stenographers for Israel, despite an iota of evidence, to destroy and dismantle one of the oldest civilizations in the world.
Indeed.
To reduce a high-functioning, frankly, glorious society, even under a dictator. Iraq was glorious. It was stunning. And they have utterly dismantled it. They have broken the backbone of the society, their intellectuals, their writers, their teachers, their doctors and engineers, and created utter despair and chaos that has persisted and will persist for generations before they can. And this was engineered by Israel. Remember this history, but we lived it. People my age remember it very well. The way that across the board, the Washington Post, the New York Times, they just repeated. repeated Israeli lies that Saddam was developing nuclear weapons, just like they were trying to do with Iran recently, by the way, that Iraq was developing nuclear weapons and they already had weapons of mass destruction. And despite the evidence, despite the UN nuclear watchdog indicating like there's no such thing, there's no evidence, and to the point that they had Zionists sent Netanyahu himself to speak before Congress, and there's that famous clip, I think, you know, most people have seen it, where he says, I guarantee you that taking out Saddam Hussein will bring peace.
Right, yes,
he said, there is no doubt whatsoever that he's trying to develop nuclear weapons, and he's this close to, I mean, this was another war that Israel pushed the United States into fighting on their behalf. So I think we have to take it in the context of the propaganda that they utilize, and they're doing that in Gaza as well. But also, like, even beyond the region, if you look in a historical sense, right, let's take two moments. For example, the Nat Turner uprising. Nat Turner was an enslaved man who led a slave rebellion against their enslavers, and it was brutal. He butchered everybody, every white person he saw, right? And so, and just like, and, at the, and I mean, this is a very old script, and just like they're doing right now, starting history at October 7th, and pointing to Palestinians as being so savage and untrustworthy and violent and irrational. They did the same thing. It was the same kind of propaganda back then. And they, you know, they slaughtered dozens, hundreds actually, of enslaved black people to teach people a lesson.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure to have you, Susan Abouhawa. Thank you so much. And we heard some of your dog there.
Thank you.
And I'm sure it contributed to this program as well. But really insightful statements that you made there made for a truly great exchange. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you. Well, that does it for this edition of Unscripted. So much to unpack there from what our guest there, Susan, said in terms of all the different things that you probably may not have heard of. For me, Kaveh Tahbwaye and the team here at Unscripted, it's goodbye until the next program.
Good morning to you all. Greetings from Tehran. You are listening to Iran Radio, and I'm your host for the next hour. We start off this hour's programs with For Humanity, a variety of subjects from the Holy Quran, which predominantly tend to be social issues, are presented in this program. After that, we have Round the World with reporters. Reporters from around the world tell us what is happening in their corner of the world. Listen to fascinating reports from countries both near and afar. And we round up this hour's programs with The Key. The program presents short answers to doubts and ambiguities concerning various Islamic and Shia topics. Stay with us.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For Humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hussein Latifi, and you're listening to our program For Humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about different Quranic verses and Islamic teachings pertaining to humanity and human beings. And in the previous episodes, we ended up talking about the destiny of humanity, which is according to the verses of the Holy Quran, the Day of Judgment. And we said this Day of Judgment is different from similar concepts in other religions. And we ended up talking about how the belief in the Day of Judgment is rooted in the innate nature of human beings. As long as they don't cover it up, as long as they don't forget it, as long as they don't bury it on their different desires and negligence. Now, one other thing that attention to one's fitra, one's innate nature, there's a benefit. We said there are different benefits of paying attention to our own innate nature. The call that we find within our heart is one other benefit of it is that it gives us a strength. Now, when everything is in accordance with the way that it was meant to be, human beings, they were created with an innate nature. That innate nature within itself had the belief in the Day of Judgment, in the continuity of life. Now, if everything goes according to the original creation, original way of things, then we can expect some positive outcome. One of these positive outcomes is the strength that is gained after one reminds himself or herself of the Day of Judgment. Now, according to this beautiful verse of the Holy Quran, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم قال الذين يظنون أنهم ملاقوا الله كم من فئة قليلة غلبت فئة كثيرة بإذن الله. This is in the context of a battle between the forces of Bani Israel, David and Talut, and on the other side we have Jalut. So then they had a situation in which the number of the people who were God-worshipping, who were on the side of truth, so their number is very few, and they didn't, some of them started having doubts that, we are doomed, this is a lost battle. Some Quran says some of those people, some of the people in the army of Banu Israel, who had this, the distinction that they had, the characteristic that they had, and their fellow warriors, they didn't have that. This characteristic was that they had the belief in the Day of Judgment. Those who had the belief in their encounter with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, they had the belief that one day we're going to encounter Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Someday we're going to meet Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this has some effect. And the effect is that they were stronger. They reminded their friends that kam min fi'atin qalila, how many times that there are fewer people that are stronger than more people, many people. So this is one aspect of the remembrance of the Day of Judgment, which is a part of our innate nature. We're going to have a break and we come back to continue our discussion.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Hossein Latifi, and you're listening to our program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. We're talking about the positive outcomes and the positive consequences of remembering the Day of Judgment. And we said that one of them is that people who have this picture of future in front of themselves, people who don't forget this greater picture of someday meeting Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, they will not fail in different tribulations of life. And people who don't have this, it's very easy for them to fail and to lose hope, to fall short. Why? Because this is, I was trying to have something from this materialistic world and I'm not having it, and there is no prospect in future for me, and then, well, they lose hope and they despair. But Quran says no, those who have this picture in front of themselves, this gives them a strength and this enables them to follow their pursuit, follow their goal with amplified motivation. And again, Quran keeps everything at balance. This strength does not bring with itself conceit and arrogance. How? Because belief, a correct belief in the Day of Judgment, brings with itself also a kind of humility. This is very important. We have some people who believe in the Day of Judgment, but this belief in the Day of Judgment would bring for them arrogance. For example, there is a verse in the Holy Quran in Surah Al-Kahf that a person said that even if there was a discussion between some people over the garden that they had, and some of them said that وَلَئِن رُدِدْتُ إِلَىٰ رَبِّي لَأَجِدَنَّ خَيْرًا مِنْهَا مُنْغَلَبًا, said, you know what, I'm being blessed in this dunya, in this life, and even if I go to the other realm, in the second coming or whatever, then I will be even more blessed. So this was his picture, that even the belief in the Day of Judgment would not humiliate him. This is not the correct belief. Remember, we said it's not just a matter of belief, it's a matter of what you believe in. If you believe in a God that is your friend and enables you to do whatever you want to do, then this is not the correct belief. And Quran says clearly about some followers of some religions that they would believe that they are friends with Allah. They are children of Allah. And because of that, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is not going to punish them. Quran says no, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to encounter and deal with everyone according to justice. So this is not, because atheists mainly, they put all kinds of belief in one bag. Some of them are superstitious, some of them are wrong, some of them are distortion, and they said, okay, dismiss all of this, and it's a dichotomy. Either you have faith, and this faith is a full set of different distortions and superstitious belief and things that even Quran rejects, and either you have that, or you are in our camp, that is the camp of atheism. No, Quran says there is the other way, and that is to have the correct belief. What's the correct belief? The correct belief has signs that a person with a reasonable level of understanding can see that if a person believes that, yes, I am the favorite creature of Allah, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has made me free to do whatever